not the answer. Inexpensive passive systems may be cost-effective, but must stand on their own merit to be cost-effective. The Northwest Power Planning Act of, I believe it was 1980, made conservation mandatory and helps to encourage energy savings and therefore solar use. The Act does not make solar use or access mandatory, but indirectly encourages solar access, and the use can be beneficial today. It takes the situation of a particular isolated lot, design criteria, selective equipment to be cost effective. The benefits remain when properly applied, but the use has dramatically reduced in the past several years. The lack of tax credits has caused almost the demise of an industry. There is a lack of current research and development. The consumer realizes that an investment must be cost effective. Those consumers who want solar benefit look for the opportunity of an existing lot or a potential retrofit. Regulation has a direct cost effect, which is not always cost benefit. Mandatory solar access is an example of a regulation that does not have a cost benefit. The ordinances that make solar access mandatory cost money for all affected permits. Let's say solar slope, solar days, sun chart, sun pattern, shadow pattern is what it meant to say, are a part of the permit. They increase the cost. I'll take a modest cost of $75 permit, and if there's 100 sets of plans, that's $7,500. That is money out of the economy and will only benefit a very small percentage of the population. Many solar designs for energy gain during the heating season also result in cooling increases during the summer season, which is an offset. Most times, if subdivisions have to be laid out where solar access is mandatory, there will be an incremental cost in excess of $500 per lot. That may not be cost effective when the loan amortization is considered. I expect Charlie will touch on that, but he already has, or he didn't really, but if you take a 10%, that $500 incremental cost amortized on a 30-year mortgage is very considerable. Comes out closer to $1,500. Most of the ordinances that are presently in place in Oregon are not the answer. Problems have come to light that are a direct cause of mandatory solar regulation. Many of these ordinances have hampered economic development. This is an unfortunate result that could have been avoided by ordinances that encourage solar use. There are developers who say they are pulling out of the market, one of which is Ben Fran, who said that they will not develop in the Portland market any more subdivisions. This was their ordinance up there was the last straw. Lenders who want a guarantee that a lot is not going to be affected by the ordinance. People who want a lot but find they cannot build their dream house because of mandatory solar access ordinances. Someone who wants a view of particularly appealing scenery buys that right, either by getting a particular lot or negotiating an agreement. Solar rights should be rightfully treated the same way. It is said that Japan guarantees solar access, but they don't have the American dream of home ownership. Only the elite owns a home in Japan. Guaranteed solar access can be had on the proper lot. The need for more mandatory regulation has not been demonstrated. Protecting solar access by mandatory regulation is not the answer for the majority of the people. The costs of that to that majority do not justify the benefits to only a few people. I hope that the staff for the Oregon State Home Builders will give the results of the computerized program that will run on the annual cost savings and the increased costs associated with solar savings on an amortized loan. There may be a negative cash flow to the consumer with only a minimal incremental cost. Contractors and buyers are concerned with affordability. Several years ago, it was demonstrated that an increase of cost of a home of $1,000 would knock approximately 6% of the potential buyers out of the market. And that is out of the American dream. Mandatory solar access aggravates this situation because it does increase the cost of housing. Encouraging solar access and use will help the American dream and therefore be a positive step. Oregon, unfortunately, has many regulations that stifle economic development and growth, rules that are unique to this state that are costly. Mandatory solar access is one of these laws that has resulted in ordinances that work counter to Governor Goldschmidt's Oregon comeback. We should be open for business, not piling restrictions that make outsiders wonder what's Oregon going to do next. Encouraging solar access and use is far better than regulating it. It costs nothing to encourage and will work like honey versus vinegar. I recommend the Salem, Oregon ordinance as one that is well thought out, not built on emotion, that is reasonable and workable. I thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much, Representative Sella.
You just mentioned the Salem ordinance. How is that different from the other ordinances?
The Salem ordinance is strictly permissive. The planning department, as I read the ordinance, this is a different packet than I had originally. It doesn't have the ordinance on it, but the planning department will put on the plan a suggested setback in a felt pen. If the lot is wide enough, you might be able to shift the house. But it's not does not say that you must protect the south wall of the adjacent property. Of the house. It's I was very impressed with the informational pack here that they've come up with, and I believe that this was also a Bonneville sponsored research, should we say. This is one thing that's very troublesome to me as well as other consumers when we come in to argue about things of this nature. It is out of our pocket. Takes me a day to drive up here and back to Klamath to testify. I lose my wages. You know, I've lost at least 2 days just on this 7 to 10 minute testimony. And yet I'm up against people who have virtually free, unlimited dollars. They can do statistically what they want, and they do frequently do distort. They only use the statistics that benefit them. And it's very hard for us who are trying to earn a living, who don't, our wages are not on the tax dollar, to come up and argue and fight for things that we believe is absolutely right. I would not do it unless I felt very firmly that it was right.
One more. I assume that the people you're referring to is the state of Oregon.
State of Oregon, Northwest Power Planning Council, BPA, local government planning departments, commissions, and so forth. Not the commissions. Those are volunteer positions.
That wasn't my question. My question is, do you think that those agencies ought to have any authority to regulate solar access?
Regulate it? No. I do not believe that it should be regulated. I like the language that is proposed, and that is to encourage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Vickers.
Under the Salem ordinance, can they deny a building permit if they do not believe that proper precautions are being taken on solar access?
My understanding of the of their ordinance is no, they cannot deny a permit. one of the ways that I've been involved in Klamath Falls City as well as Klamath Falls County writing of an ordinance because of the existing law.
Well, when you say because of the existing law, what do you mean? I mean, the existing law says may adopt. Now, why is anybody doing it because of the existing law?
Because of the carrot and the stick of Bonneville, I think, is part of it.
Well, that's not state law.
The planning departments, this is tongue-in-cheek, I don't want to take it wrong, but I refer to them many times, and I have face-to-face, as paid agitators. Their job is planning, granted, and therefore they do promote these type of ideas.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
I take it then that you think that this computer data that was run by the home builders is a completely objective bit of information and not done at all to represent their point of view?
The Watson program, which is the one that I was referring to, is a BPA program.
Well, you said the home builders had run some information about cost.
Using the same program, using the BPA program.
Using the program that BPA supposedly created because out of their own special interest and to promote what they want to do. Huh?
It's not substantiated, but it is suspected. For instance, on the RSDD, the Residential Demonstration Program, that much of the data has been finagled and much of the cost. I have myself talked to several builders whose costs come out differently than what was submitted. So statistically, I do question much of it.
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I may have missed this. We've heard from the home builders now saying that there's added costs, and I guess as someone who's bought a home and may buy another home in the future, do a lot of people you sell homes to say, I'm not interested in solar access, or this is something that I'm totally unwilling to pay for? See, I know people who think it's a real positive thing and say, yes, it costs money, but I'm willing to pay a little more for that. So I guess I'm asking for what experience you have talking to people who actually buy homes with solar access.
When I am talking to somebody, which I am doing right now to somebody in Keno, I have urged them to consider passive solar water heating. This is on a retrofit. It's on an addition to a house. And I'm going out probably Saturday or Sunday with a compass to see their actual orientation. The cost would be in the neighborhood of $1,500 to put that particular unit in. I'm not sure that it's going to be cost effective. I will take my estimate down to PPL and get their reaction to find out if the power bills will be reduced sufficiently to get, a 7-year payback. Or can they put that $1,500 in the bank at 7-8%? CD or whatever, and come out with more money. That's what I refer to as cost payback. But I do encourage it.
One more comment. I guess maybe, and we may hear from these people today, I don't know, that I'm looking for the person out there who's actually experienced this. I mean, you are a special interest, if I may say so. The other side of the issue is a special interest. I guess the consumer who's actually living in the home or buying the home, I'm not sure you can provide those people, but I hope we get to hear from them somewhere along.
So I estimate on my own home, I get about 30% of my utility is offset by the use of solar. I have a solar water heater. I'm oriented. I'm up on Moena Heights. You're from down that area, and I look right down runway 36, so I know I'm facing, and I can look out on Mount Shasta. So I'm oriented where I get a whale of a lot of my heat. During the winter, it gets too hot.
Representative Shaw.
Just a philosophical question. A lot of people tell me that that they like to use things that are renewable energy, like recycling and things like that, even if they don't get cost-effective cost benefits from it, because they're looking down the road somewhere that we might have an energy shortage and might have to build another coal-fired plant or something. Do you think that that a person shouldn't be looking down the road and putting in solar facilities and guaranteed solar access, so maybe we could prevent for another 20 years the building of another plant that might cause air pollution and things like that?
I very definitely believe that we need to build for 20, 30 years down the road. The coal, the oil, and so forth are all, as I mentioned, finite. There's only a limited amount of that, and that's it.
Then if you're making a cost analysis on a solar project of some kind, and you say that in 7 years it should be paid off, you don't think you should factor in some factors there that might delay the cost of another power plant construction?
This is where I would go on experts. I am not one who can say that a $5,000 solar benefit is better off, a better return in the bank, because I don't project the costs out. But I think that people look for at the money in their pocket, the disposable income. The majority of the citizens today do not look at 20 or 30 years down the road for an investment payback that far down the road. They want to see more now.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. At this point, I'd like to call John Fragonzi and Joel Smith. Two of you would come up, and then when we get through with the two of you, we're going to close the hearing on this bill at this time. We will continue it next week. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is John Fragonzi.
Which one of you is Representative Peterson?
I'd like to welcome John.
Oh, good. I want to give you the opportunity.
I figured
you
would. I was going to make some comments.
All right, fine. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. And it's friggin' easy.
Okay.
He'll straighten that out.
Friggin' easy.
That's right.
Friggin'.
That was once said. thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to read a letter from the mayor and then just make a few brief comments, and I will keep them brief. And in interest of that, I'm going to skip the first two paragraphs of that letter because they are kind of introductory. Getting right into the meat of the letter, since the city enacted its ordinance, we have had a healthy, steady growth, especially since 1986. Since 1981, we have seen 259 new single-family homes, 56 mobile homes, 24 multifamily residences constructed. In the same time period, 184 new lots have been created by partition, and 557 new lots have been created by subdivision or PUD. Most of these approvals are currently in various stages of development. During this time, we've granted 102 variances to the zoning ordinance, only two of which pertain to the solar access ordinance. In 1984, the city conducted a survey with BPA help based on a scientific random sample to see what the general public and the development community thought about the ordinance. We were surprised by the overwhelming approval of the ordinance. 89% of the respondents thought that local governments had a responsibility to promote solar energy. 91% thought regulating solar access was a valid activity for local governments. 96% thought we should continue to enforce the ordinance. The development community was similarly supportive. Out of 40 persons interviewed, only 4 had negative comments about the ordinance. The others generally supported the concept but had some suggestions on how to improve the operation of the ordinance. These suggestions were later incorporated into revisions of the code. We are dismayed, to say the least, that one of the most successful and popular programs the city has now threatened with this bill. In the 6 years that I have been mayor, there has never been a complaint directed to my office regarding this issue. It is our position that this is exactly the type of issue which is best handled on the local level. We have demonstrated that our city has successfully and responsibly enacted an ordinance which protects solar access without in any way hindering development. We believe that we should be allowed to continue along the path we have chosen, as should other cities. We would request that the committee kill this bill, as in our opinion it has no merit whatsoever. Thank you for your consideration of our testimony. Sincerely, L. Gordon Medeiros, Mayor, City of Ashland. I'd just like to add a couple of other comments, if I may, just very briefly. I was the person that wrote the ordinance. It was the first ordinance of its kind, and I guess I might take some credit for starting all this problem. I also have assisted many other communities in developing solar access ordinances and have corresponded with people from around the world on solar access. This is not something new. I have, since working on this ordinance, have found a lot of solar access work that was done in Greece in 500 BC. There's solar access ordinances in Manchester, England, and Mata Mata, New Zealand, and in Bari, Italy. One of the very significant solar access ordinances that are used are in San Francisco and New York City, which are used to regulate the amount of light that comes to the street level so that these cities can, where the skyscrapers, they can get light on the sidewalks. In addition, you ought to know that the very first setbacks were provided so that there could be light and air given to buildings. And the reason that buildings were originally required to be set apart a certain amount of distance was specifically for sunlight access. What we're talking about here is a new twist on a very old story, that of urban planners trying to provide, through regulation, solar access in urban settings. In other development news in Ashland, I'd like to say that we had 77 new homes last year, 9 new homes in March. The number of motel units went from 500 to 900 since we adopted the ordinance. We have 40 apartment units starting and another 100 on board. We are in a building boom in Ashland. And we have, just briefly, just off the top of my head, I can think of two of the most popular developments. All have lots of 5 to 4,000 square feet. One has the famous North-South Street that was talking about. All of these have gone through the solar access ordinance. Now, I understand that the Portland home builders have a problem with the Portland ordinance. As planning director for the city, I would like to say that I think that they should work out their problems in Portland. We have a successful ordinance that we have been working with for a long time, and it is not a controversy in Ashland. And I don't see any reason why we should be up here defending something that we, well, I can see why we're up here as part of the process, but I would hope that it would stop here, that we have an ordinance that's quite successful and popular. And really, I think that the attitude in Ashland is one of surprise that someone would be against something as positive as solar access. We really haven't had the problems. And I'd just like to say that 20 local governments have adopted this ordinance. There were 20 planning commissions that reviewed this. Each one of them, I think, took at least a year to go through the process of adoption. There were at least 40 public hearings around the state. There were 20 city councils that took a vote, and they are subject to just as intense of pressures, pro and con, as any of you are in terms of which way their vote should go. These ordinances were controversial. They were front page items. They were adopted in 20 cities around the state. I think that you can at some times have seen experiences where one or two cities have taken irresponsible actions. I don't think that 20 local governments will rush lemming-like in a hysteria to adopt solar access ordinances without considering all the facts, and I think that we should be allowed to continue with our ordinance.
Mr. Chairman? Wasn't
it
Representative Peterson insist we have a hearing on this bill?
No, it was not.
Representative Peterson.
I guess I'd like to echo a little of what John has said, having lived in Ashland for a number of years and knowing a number of builders in Southern Oregon, that I haven't heard Ashland builders say this is awful legislation and it's hurting us. In fact, there seems to be, as John pointed out, pretty good support for it. I would like to ask you a question, John, and you answered it in some degree, but maybe you could elaborate a little. Charlie Hale, the first person who testified, commented that there's a real concern about the large-scale developments, that it's easy, I think, in a city like Ashland where it's just one house per lot to do the orienting and so on, but with large-scale developments. And you said there have been some in Ashland recently. Can you talk about the problems
or lack of problems with mm-hmm. a large kiln zone?
Well, we've had several, and of course you probably know them. There's 100 to from 30 to 100 units in single family developments, and scattered all throughout the city in all kinds of price ranges, in terrain varying from very steep north facing slopes to fairly flat, very small lots with good views. There have been our ordinance is fairly flexible, and we can work these things out with the developer. For example, one on North Whiteman Street, the lots are very narrow. There's a north-south street. We worked out kind of a custom solar access plan for them. Our ordinance allows them to do that. Now, maybe the problem in Portland is their ordinance. I mean, it might be. But I think that that's something that we've worked out locally, and that's why we don't have a problem with our builders, is that we've listened to our builders and accommodated them. And we've been through 557 lots, and they all had to meet solar access. Some were more problems with others, but everybody got through on the first time. I don't think there would have been any appeals on any of these that related to solar access. The only ones that were turned down were developments in the floodplain of Bear Creek.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
I think maybe you just answered my question to some extent, but do you have a variance procedure?
We have a couple of things that are very handy. First of all, in a new development, there's a standard that they can meet, and if they don't want to meet that standard, we have options to work out. They still have to meet a solar access standard, but we can locate the building more accurately, can get the buildings a lot closer together. Where there's a voluntary limit of height, we can get buildings a lot closer together and work those things out. The second thing we have is that if one wants to build this, third thing is actually you can shade drainage ditches in Ashland, no problem. Nobody's protecting drainage ditches or drainage easements. You can shade easements, you can shade flag drives, you can shade that kind of thing. The third thing is that if two neighbors agree, one can shade the other's property as long as it's not shading a window. They can shade his front yard, he can shade his woodshed, he can shade his garage. And that's helped out work out a lot of problems, but again, that's a very expedited situation, and both prop owners have to agree. I should say the only problems that we've had with the ordinance are when someone thinks they're getting shaded illegally, and then they get very excited.
Yes, Jim.
Yes, Representative Parks.
Where you have a person who wants to build and they disagree with the building department, do you have a variance procedure where they can go to the city council and ask
yes.
for a variance?
Yes.
Yeah, that was my question. You have.
Yeah, it's standard variance.
In other words, that would accommodate an old lot, say an old house burns down or something, they could be accommodated, or could you do that right in the building department?
No. Well, if the neighbor that's going to be shaded would agree to it, we can do it in the building, in the planning department.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a disagreement, then it has to go to a hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Soa.
Is it your interpretation, then, that your ordinance is within present state law?
Yes, it's within present state law. We did adopt the ordinance before that law existed, because we had at that time general power to devise setbacks that complied with our comprehensive plan and all the other state laws. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
sir.
My name is Joel Smith. I'm a licensed engineer. I've been in the practice in engineering. I started about 20 years ago, and I've practiced in the Bend area for the last 10 years. I'm presently the president of Terrascope Incorporated, which is a consulting firm. A big part of our business is in site planning and design. We pride ourselves in using the geophysical characteristics of a site to increase the aesthetic, environmental, and economic considerations of the project. I think we were probably the first and foremost in Deschutes County to deal with a solar ordinance from a consultant's basis. I think we saw a totally different side than what the media or the public officials saw. I've submitted three maps for your review. The first map, which is a staple on the bottom, was the first solar setback map that I ever did. At the time, a friend of mine and I were looking at buying a computer to do this. The cost of that machine was about $12,000, and we didn't feel that it would justify itself. After we submitted that, talked to the county planning department about what the ordinance really said and what it really wanted. We then submitted the first map, which asked for a variance based on existing vegetation, which is allowed in the ordinance. I think the biggest problem we ran into with the solar ordinance in Deschutes County was that the planning staff was not prepared to enforce the ordinance. They did not have the guidelines or the design manuals ready at the time the ordinance was in effect. We submitted this plan. We were told this wasn't sufficient. I asked why not. They said, well, you haven't shown us that the vegetation shades the lot to the north of this particular piece of property. It sure seemed obvious to me that a 59-foot high tree would throw more shade than a 30-foot high house. Subsequent to that, we went to the next program, which was to actually draw the shade patterns of the trees and show that they shaded the lot. The other requirement was the engineer's statement, which is shown on the drawings. The only thing I know that I could have done in addition to that was take my firstborn child down and let him hold it as hostage in case something was wrong with the plan itself. I felt that...
Did you do that?
No, I didn't. I only have one, and I'm afraid that's just too valuable to me. I found that after a little practice and a little work on this, that I could go to a lot and tell a person within 5 or 10 minutes whether that lot would come under the existing vegetation variance to the ordinance. I believe that at one time I went to a work session that was put on by the planning department, and I was told that there were 13 lots submitted for this particular exception.